How can developing countries use technology policy to catch up with the world frontier? This debate is often framed as a dichotomy. You can either adopt the best technology from abroad, or you can innovate at home. Today we'll ask, why not do both? Our conversation will take us from the agricultural sector in Brazil to the electronics sector in Taiwan. Two very different settings, but both case studies of successful attempts to move up the technology ladder. Taiwan is now home to TSMC, today the sole manufacturer of the world's most advanced chips, and one of the 10 most valuable companies on Earth. Taiwan went from GDP per capita on a par with Bangladesh to a high-income economy in a single generation. Meanwhile, in Brazil, a government research institute sent its scientists abroad to do PhDs, developed new soybean varieties that could grow in soil that no one had farmed yet, and turned a country that was previously reliant on food imports into the world's largest agricultural exporter. Welcome to Ideas in Development, a VoxDev podcast on economic policy and research. I'm Oliver Hanney, the managing editor here at VoxDev, and my guest today has dug into both of these stories and thought about the implications they have for technology policy in the developing world. Karthik Tadapalli is a PhD student at UC Berkeley and also a prolific writer of interesting articles, whether that's his recent piece on Taiwan in the Asterisk magazine or on his own Substack. I'll link to both of these in the show notes for this episode, which will also be on Substack. Karthik, welcome to Ideas in Development.
Thank you for having me, Oliver.
Great. So I mentioned these two case studies in the introduction, Brazil and Taiwan. Maybe let's start with Taiwan. Take us back to 1973. What does the country look like then, and what is this institute called the ITRI?
Like you said, in 1973, Taiwan was firmly middle income. It was about the same GDP per capita as Bangladesh today. And similar to most middle income countries or developing countries today, its main product was low value consumer electronics and textiles. You know, made in Taiwan was a mark of things being made quite cheaply. Taiwanese firms were essentially subcontractors for Western electronics companies. They took the components that were shipped to them and they assembled them together. And there was no edge in that other than just having cheap labor. And they wanted to change this. They decided that that wasn't really good enough for them. And so they started a research institute in 1973 called ITRI, the Industrial Technology Research Institute. ITRI's mandate was to develop Taiwan's technological capabilities in frontier sectors. There were a few of them, but the one that I focus on is electronics because that's the one that was the most dramatically successful. It was a lab that combined some pre-existing labs that had already existed, put them under the Ministry of Economic Affairs and said, you are going to make Taiwan a technological frontier country. And it started really small. It was just about 300 employees, only six of whom had PhDs, and you had a lot more people by the end. Now it's, you know, spinning out multiple billion-dollar companies and started from a place that many developing countries are at today.
And the pivot point in the story of this institute, in the early years at least, is a licensing deal. Could you tell us about what that licensing deal was, why it was so consequential, and what it reveals about the correct approach or the right approach to technology adoption?
The initial starting point, if you want to get into the electronics industry, is that you need to have the capabilities. This was not a joke of a sector. It was really high technology and quite sophisticated for a country that didn't have any previous capabilities. So they started off by trying to license an existing technology from an American company, the Radio Corporation of America. RCA was one of the major American chip makers at the time, and they licensed their technology to ITRI so that their chips could be produced in Taiwan. This was actually a pretty difficult deal for ITRI to get. They had actually approached candidates in Europe and Japan and other candidates in the US, but none of them actually showed much interest. The reason why RCA agreed was because one of the people who worked at RCA high up was a man named Pan Wen Yuan, who was Chinese American and was approached by ITRI and was on board with this plan. So he influenced RCA to take this deal, which was quite an expensive deal for ITRI at the time. It wasn't a small amount of money for an organization with a pretty small budget. But they ended up signing this deal, and it was the best thing they could have done. The reason why this deal was so consequential was because not only did they get the technology blueprints that they needed to produce, they also got training. They were able to send a team of engineers to America, to RCA factories, to learn not just the formal process for producing chips, but the tacit knowledge, the informal understanding that you only get by being on the production line. They learned about manufacturing processes, quality control. These are all things that they developed a lot of understanding of and then came back to Taiwan with. And this early core of engineers ended up being quite influential. They went on to lead the companies of, you know, UMC, TSMC. They were all high up in those companies when those were eventually formed. What it says about the technology adoption question is that what you need when you're really trying to adopt a technology is you need people who have the skill. Without those engineers and without that training, the RCA deal would have been helpful. It would have been nice to produce those chips when they weren't producing anything before, but it wouldn't possibly have led to the modern dominance that we see.
And you kind of alluded to it there in your answer that this institute does something that kind of seems a bit unusual. It doesn't just build capabilities for itself, but you mentioned staff going on to lead UMC and TSMC. The institute deliberately spins off capabilities into private companies. Why was that model so effective, and how exactly did it work?
The spin-off model started with the RCA deal because as part of that deal, ITRI began a demonstration plant. So it was a plant that produced chips according to RCA specifications just to demonstrate that ITRI really did know how to produce these. They didn't just have the theoretical knowledge. And they made this demonstration plant and it was a huge success. It actually produced chips with a higher yield rate than RCA's own facilities in the US. So it was a ridiculously successful plan. And they didn't just want to stick to producing those chips. They wanted to level up. They wanted to focus their own manpower on taking those engineers and that process knowledge and saying, how can we produce even more advanced chips? Because the RCA chips, the deal was for chips that were low powered, a little bit a generation behind. And so they wanted to get to the frontier. But they also didn't want to waste the capabilities they developed on just a commercialization of existing capabilities. So they spun out the plant, the blueprints, and even some of the engineers into a brand new company. That was the United Microelectronics Corporation. That's UMC, which in 1985 became Taiwan's most valuable company. It was producing chips that were quite valuable, whereas all the other Taiwanese firms were still doing low-value assembly work. So the spin-off model works by ITRI taking this plan to companies and saying, we want to solicit investment from you because, you know, they are still ultimately a research institute. They don't have the budget to be commercializing. They don't have the capital to be commercializing this production and turning it into a full-fledged company. So instead, they solicited investment from other firms in the industry, which ended up being double duty politically because it meant that the other firms in the industry also got to share in the benefits from ITRI's research. They didn't just stand on the sidelines while UMC thrived. They actually benefited from it through their investment in UMC. And this was something that remained true with other ITRI spinoffs.
Yeah, and you've touched on it there, the fact that this institute was able to manage its political relationships pretty well. And that's kind of one lesson for why it was successful. This is an aspect that I guess is often overlooked when giving policy advice or recommendations, which tend to fall into kind of the optimal bucket rather than considering the political ramifications of a policy and then kind of working back from there. Would you be able to unpack that a bit more in terms of how they were managed, how they were able to manage the political side of things?
At a high level, ITRI's work you can think of as industrial policy. And I know you talk about industrial policy on this podcast sometimes, but there's actually a very important difference between something like R&D support and something like subsidies or tariffs that make up a classic industrial policy. Because if your industrial policy is implemented via subsidies or credit to firms, they don't have to do anything differently to take advantage of that. It's essentially free money in their pocket. But if you give them a blueprint for a high technology plant, they can't actually make any money off of that unless they're willing to actually upgrade their capabilities. So R&D support enforces productivity growth in a way that is inherent to the technology. It doesn't require you to say, we can govern firms perfectly and choose their actions according to our plan. It's built into the technology. So it's much harder to hijack. But the flip side, of course, is that if it's not free money in their pockets, firms and industry could easily just view this as wasteful and say, well, this isn't actually beneficial for us. We'd much rather this money be diverted into our pockets, become part of our slush fund. So how did ITRI avoid that? Mainly, they focused on producing things that were really valuable to the industry. They said, you want profits, but you can't get them without us because we have the technological capabilities and we want to give them to you. We're on your side, but you have to let us do our job in order to get the benefits of that. So one salient example of this came with photomasks. Photomasks are a piece of equipment used in making chips, and they're quite important to the process. And so you often want to duplicate them because they're a little bit fragile. But duplicating photomasks is quite difficult and very expensive if you outsource it to international firms, which is what they had to do initially. So ITRI licensed mask duplication technology from an American company and started providing those services in-house. They essentially said, any Taiwanese firm that is making chips, if you want your mask to be duplicated, come to us and we'll do it. And when that service became so popular that it was again overwhelming ITRI's capability to provide it, they spun that out again into another company, the Taiwan Mask Corporation. So this was a clear example of how they were providing something tangibly important to firms. If firms said, you know, ITRI is not valuable, we need to shut it down, they would have lost access to those services. And this isn't just about the long term, oh, well, they might not get the benefits in the future, because it's not always the case that companies will take that into account. They might be a little bit short-termist. But when ITRI is providing services to them tangibly right now, it becomes a lot easier to justify why they exist and why they need the budget and resources that they do. And this kind of worked ultimately because Taiwan's industry was in kind of a sweet spot developmentally. It needed to be large enough that it was politically influential in keeping ITRI sustainable, but it also needed to be unproductive or hungry enough that it benefited from these capabilities. If it was just one but not the other, this might not have worked.
Great. So you've talked about UMC and kind of the early days of this industry and how it started to get going. And I guess the most famous example of the success of this institute is now seen in TSMC, which I talked about in the introduction, which is this kind of huge company. Could you tell us a bit about how this kind of institute and the ecosystem in Taiwan kind of snowballed into TSMC?
So UMC, starting out in 1980, is actually a dramatic success. It's the best thing that's happened to Taiwan, and they're very happy about it. But people would barely be able to tell you the name of UMC. They may not even be able to tell you what it stands for. Everyone knows what TSMC is. TSMC is the successor, the crown jewel. It comes right after UMC. And it comes about because Taiwan is realizing that the capability to produce chips is getting a little bit more important than just the capability to design them. This is part of the fabless revolution that people talk about in the chip industry, where they were separating production and design. And this comes about as a process through ITRI's research when they're trying to develop chips and they are developing the capability to produce these very large chips. And they're realizing that this actually is its own project. Morris Chang, the founder of TSMC, was actually the president of ITRI at the time when he made this plan. And it was on behalf of ITRI that he developed the idea for TSMC. And eventually it became such a success that he stepped down, spun it out into the company, and turned it into the giant success that it is today that has been endlessly mythologized. The point I want to emphasize is that it was kind of a natural continuation of the spin-off model. It wasn't something out of the blue. that was totally unanticipated. It happened because ITRI was used to spinning off their projects into companies.
And now if we switch gears a bit and move countries and sectors, we find ourselves in Brazil and we will discuss the Embrapa story, which actually begins with a country, Brazil, that was at the time reliant on food imports, despite being this vast agrarian economy. Could you tell us a bit about what was going wrong in Brazil at the time?
So Brazil has both tropical and subtropical regions because it's quite large. And most of its farming was actually concentrated in the subtropical south around Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro. And it was beneficial to do that because farming is much easier in these regions due to the temperate farming techniques that you could imagine using. The problem, of course, is that most of the land in Brazil would become off limits if you only use these subtropical or temperate farming techniques. In fact, there were huge biomes that were just completely unused for agriculture because it wasn't really known how to make farming profitable there. So even though most of Brazil was agrarian, most, in fact, was being fed by a small amount of farming in the subtropical south. And so they couldn't produce enough food to feed the country. And in fact, they not only relied on food imports, they had to rely on food aid given by the US to poor countries at the time.
And at that point, what were Brazil trying to do about the situation? I guess both in terms of conventional agricultural policy and how exactly did a research institute fit into that?
So the first part of the standard playbook is rural extension, taking farmers the knowledge and the techniques developed to make their farming more productive. And that had existed since the 1950s with American collaboration, but the knowledge base for this extension was just not transferring to tropical conditions because agents couldn't answer farmers' questions about things that were specific to tropical areas. And in fact, their internal evaluations showed that farmers who got rural extension did not do any better than farmers who didn't get rural extension. So it was an open secret among them that rural extension just wasn't working. There are other development policy playbooks for agriculture that were tried and were in fact helpful. These are, you know, having subsidized credit for farmers to adopt modern inputs, subsidizing the fertilizer industry, and building a fertilizer industry through protectionism. They did all of these things and they were all quite important. And I don't want to underrate the role that those forces played. But they do assume that you're applying a formula that's known to work elsewhere. They don't give you the ability to develop new varieties of fertilizer or make land arable that wasn't previously arable or new forms of soil treatment that don't exist because they aren't useful in the US, which is where all the agricultural R&D is happening. So that was where the scientific policy came into it, to say that there are things that are not possible with the existing science because the existing science was developed for different ecosystems. And they needed Brazil-specific knowledge that would help the agricultural productivity grow.
Yeah, and Embrapa makes a decision kind of early on that sounds almost reckless. It spends 20% of its budget in its first decade actually sending staff overseas for PhDs before kind of producing any results from Embrapa itself. How exactly do they defend that decision to embark on that type of policy? I guess there was also a similar policy at play in Taiwan, right? Where they were sending people overseas to do PhDs.
Yeah, both Embrapa and ITRI make this surprising decision to invest very heavily in building up the capital of their researchers. That's before they've produced any results. They treat knowledge sharing as a long-term capital investment rather than just, okay, we need to get the immediate output, so let's burn our resources right now. Because ultimately, both of these organizations were starting off with quite small teams. They just didn't have that many researchers. And so if you want to achieve any results in the long term, you do need to build up that stock, not only the quantity of researchers, but also the quality of researchers. You need people who are trained in techniques around the world, because even though the knowledge that you might learn in the US isn't directly applicable to Brazil, the skills that you get from training as an agricultural researcher in Brazil would end up being very helpful to making the farming more productive. So they decide that it's worth investing in this because they need experts. They need scientists, not just people who have some knowledge and a small team. And they make the decision to say, we don't need the immediate wins, or we'll of course try to start on research projects, but we're going to make sure that we're building up our balance sheet a lot more than we're spending it down.
I guess the first major win of this research project in Brazil is that they are able to make the Cerrado farmable, which essentially unlocks an area 3 times the size of Texas that previously people hadn't really been able to grow anything in. Could you describe what that involved scientifically and why it mattered so much economically?
Yeah, the core problem of the Cerrado was soil acidity. The soil is just naturally very highly acidic, and that prevents crops from absorbing nutrients in the soil, even when those nutrients are actually present. So fertilizer doesn't solve that problem. And on top of that, it is also inherently nutrient poor. Finally, they have the climate problem. It's much hotter and drier than Brazil's agricultural south. So all three of these factors made it quite difficult to do any farming in the Cerrado and just made it quite wasted as a resource. So Embrapa's solution was multifold to deal with this multi-stage problem. They started by liming the soil, that's treating the soil with an alkaline solution to neutralize it and make it less acidic. They bred new soybean varieties that were specifically tolerant of the heat that would be able to grow in the Cerrado. They, of course, developed new varieties of fertilizer that would treat the deficiencies specifically present in the Cerrado soil. And so all three of these together were quite transformative in the Cerrado's agricultural capacity, which is why now it hosts a large chunk of Brazil's farming. I believe it's something like 70% of their soybean production. And that's essentially a tripling of the amount of agricultural land that's available, and therefore quite dramatically increased Brazil's agricultural output.
And returning to the theme of surviving the politics, the Embrapa story is particularly interesting because it had this sister agency, Embrata, that gets shut down overnight after backing the wrong presidential candidate. Meanwhile, Embrapa manages to survive and obviously becomes this big success in the long term. Could you talk a bit about why one succeeded and one failed in on the political side of things, and also maybe explain a bit what this sister agency was set up to do?
Yeah, so Embrata was a sister agency of Embrapa that was focused on rural extension. So while Embrapa developed new knowledge, Embrata focused on bringing it to farmers. And through circumstances that are not super clear in the historical record, Embrata officials decided that they wanted to support Luiz da Silva, aka Lula, in the 1989 presidential election. But Lula ended up losing, and the new president shut Embrata down overnight. He said, we don't need political enemies in this administration. And remember, Embrata worked on rural extension, which meant that their presence was much more tangible and much more applied than the sort of ineffable science work happening in Embrapa. So if Embrata could go, Embrapa could as well. So Embrapa really needed to be politically savvy. They never took partisan sides. They cultivated allies across the political spectrum. They didn't anger anybody. And this paid off quite a lot. You know, we talked about their policy of sending scientists for training. This was actually a policy that was strongly opposed by the Minister for Agriculture at the time, who nominally was in charge of Embrapa. But because Embrapa officials were quite chummy with the president, they got him to overrule this decision and support their training policy. A clear example of how you needed the political savviness to make this long-term capability worth investing in. And so that was a key part of Embrapa's political savviness. There were a couple of others. First of all, it wasn't established as part of the university system. At the time, Brazil was under a military dictatorship, and the university system was quite hostile to the military and vice versa. So because of this, they didn't want Embrapa's research to be subject to enhanced scrutiny that would come from being in the university system. They wanted to be on the side of the government. But they also did just more broadly tons of marketing. They invested heavily in public communication. They held press releases. They did seminars for journalists. They showed them demonstrations of what Embrapa was doing. They mandated that scientists give interviews to journalists, which the scientists hated, by the way. But they mandated it because it was really important that they were always pounding the pavement, showing people, this is what we're doing for you. On their 10th anniversary, they actually ran a TV campaign from like the New York marketing firm, showing a herd of cattle marching into Sao Paulo and saying, the results of Embrapa's research are coming to town. They made it very clear that we are making your food cheaper and you need us. You need to send money to us.
You discuss in your article about this, this concept of induced innovation, which was kind of the organizing principle behind Embrapa's research priorities. I guess essentially that involves focusing on your most expensive input. Can you explain that framework and why it helped Embrapa so much to have that kind of clarity of direction?
So think about, as a comparison, the US. When the US was growing in the 19th century, it was expanding westward along the frontier. There was abundant land and just not enough labor to farm at all. They had wide open swaths of land that they couldn't do anything with. So American agricultural innovation said, we need to build machines that reduce the amount of labor that we need. We could save labor in our process. We'll build tractors, combine harvesters. And so these machines allowed a small number of workers to farm really large tracts of land, which is what America needed at the time. So that's the idea of induced innovation. You should target your innovation efforts at the scarce input, which in the US was labor. But in Brazil, actually, counterintuitively, because of how big it is, the scarce input was land. Remember, the land was mainly in the productive South. It wasn't in most of the country. And in fact, it was specifically around Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro, which were urbanizing. They were becoming cities, and therefore the cost of using them for agriculture was going up. Because land prices were going up, that would make food more expensive. It would make the crops less competitive on the global scale. So they needed to have cheaper land in order to develop a productive farming sector that could compete internationally and also deliver cheap food to people. That's why Embrapa said, we need to focus on land. There's a lot of things that we could focus on. We could try to make new fertilizer. We could try to make new varieties. But what Brazil really needs is more land. And they got this by focusing on the price signal, which is, you know, the most expensive input was land. Alternatively, the most scarce input was land. And that kind of market-driven focus on what input are we going to innovate on was the idea of induced innovation. And it was quite essential for making Embrapa have a clear direction. Without that, they could have been spread too thin. Maybe let's try to make some land arable, but also let's try to make some labor-saving equipment and maybe also try to make some new fertilizer and also some new seeds. But this is just not something you can do when you're a nascent research institute that needs one focused and high-impact win to justify why you should exist.
And if we're thinking about both Embrapa in Brazil and ITRI in Taiwan, rather than just saying, okay, policymakers in the rest of the world, you need to replicate these exactly, what do you think are some of the enduring and maybe generalizable lessons that apply to countries which now find themselves perhaps in situations like Taiwan and Brazil were in the 1970s? I guess you've shown that this adopted versus indigenous technology paradigm is somewhat of a false dichotomy. So what does it look like to successfully do both at the same time?
It is true that the adopted versus innovation question is a big part of discourse around development of technology. And the thing that these case studies show is that both of those come from the same source. You start by having a clear path to the technology ladder, by having some angle on what you're going to do. You develop the human capital necessary to solve it, especially by getting your people to be trained abroad. And then you focus on getting long-term investment by navigating the political waters. These are things that we've talked about in the context of both Embrapa and ITRI, even though they're totally different settings. So that is a key part of it, is focusing on building up the human capital, focusing on maintaining the political balance needed to do long-term investments in a developing country. So I do think there are quite common lessons. I do also think that the main lesson from this is not, let's just copy ITRI or let's just copy Embrapa. Both of these were actually doing quite different things. For example, we talked about how both of them were being politically savvy, But in ITRI's case, that was mainly about trying to maintain funding by appealing to industry. Whereas in Brazil, the political base was actually not the farmers themselves. The political base was the urban, you know, population where the military was based under Brazil's military government. So it wasn't that they applied the same direct policies, it's that they had the same thinking. Let's be strategic in this way. So I think that there is a fair amount of context specificity to how exactly you should be building up your human capital and how exactly you should be focusing on the political constraints necessary for long-term investment. But those are, I think, the two important decisions that you have to make in whatever context you're going to apply them.
And I was wondering how you think about the usefulness of case studies like these that you've written about and discussed today, compared to, I imagine, the more empirical work you're doing as part of your PhD. The articles you've written are clearly relevant for policy, but they're not exactly publishable in an economics journal. So why do it? And are these case studies just second best whilst we wait for the empirical studies to follow? Or do you think we're learning something in addition that maybe an empirical study wouldn't capture?
I used to be a skeptic of case studies. In particular, the chief version of this is China, right? Everyone wants to be China. Everyone says, let's just do what China did. You know, a lot of successful development policy advice, or successful in the popular sense, is basically, how could you be more like East Asia? Of course, How Asia Works is the most successful development book of our generation, and that's how it works. I used to be skeptical of that. I think now I just accept it, that this is part of how people learn. And I don't think it's actually a bad thing. I do think it's complementary to having empirical research, but empirical research can't really get into the same level of insight in a way. You can't use empirical research to think about the motivations of people making decisions at a time or what they were thinking. You can only get that from their accounts, from the accounts of people around them. And I did draw on scholarly sources for these articles, but they ended up being primarily qualitative articles. So these are articles published in, say, management journals or technology journals that will be much more comfortable publishing case studies. Business schools often do case studies. So I don't think there's anything wrong with learning from case studies. I do think that it would be nice to have more empirical evidence. For example, there's a recent paper about Embrapa from some researchers. That was initially how I discovered this organization. And ITRI, I mean, the reason why I started looking into them was because I wanted to write a paper about them, but the data is, in fact, quite difficult to come by. So these are complementary, but especially when you're thinking about technology policy, there just aren't enough successful cases for case studies to be a bad idea, in a way. Case studies are bad if you think about survivorship bias. Well, you know, you only learn from the ones that succeeded, therefore you don't learn all the ways it could fail. Well, if there are very few case studies that succeed, even the survivorship bias still captures something important. It may not be sufficient, and it almost certainly will not be, but it could be necessary.
Thanks so much, Karthik. I will link to both of the articles you've written about technology policy in Brazil and Taiwan in the show notes. This has been Ideas in Development. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We also do write-ups to accompany each episode, which we post to our Substack. All of our past episodes, as ever, are available at voxdev.org.